Today on Maine Calling, Maine author and playwright Monica Wood. Monica Wood's new novel, How to Read a Book, is already receiving rave reviews. People magazine names it one of the best books to read in May. The New York Times calls it a charming, open-hearted novel, deceptively easy to read but layered with sharp observations, hard truths, and rich ideas. But the book might not have been published, and in fact was published a year late because of a strike at the book's publisher, a strike the author supported. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Monica Wood joins us to talk about the novel, taking a stand when others did not, overcoming tough personal challenges, the other Maine writers who lift her up, and, if there's time, cats and football. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. By Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In her new novel, How to Read a Book, author Monica Wood tells the story of friendships, tragedy, recovery, and how books can transform us. Monica, of course, is a best-selling author and memoirist, and she's also a playwright and so much more. Monica Wood, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thank you, Jen. I love doing this show.
It has been quite a weekend for you.
As I think God said, okay, this is your week. Enjoy it.
New York Times book review, mm-hmm. a book review in the New York Times, People magazine saying one of the top 10 books of this month. Can't wait till the end of the year when they put it on that list, too. And then becoming Doctor of Philosophy.
Doctor of Humane Letters.
Humane Letters, I'm sorry.
And honorary, so
at UMaine Farmington. I can't call you doctor.
No.
But you also gave the commencement address at UMaine
did.
Farmington. And, yeah. and Monica, I wanted to start by talking about that. It's a beautiful commencement address, easy to find on YouTube because your husband posted it there. Did you know that?
No, but I'm not surprised. I find all kinds of things he's put out there after the fact. My number one fan.
What strikes me watching it is that when you gave this commencement address to the graduates at UMaine Farmington on Saturday, you didn't talk about persistence. You didn't talk about the importance of writing well. You didn't talk about overcoming adversity. All of those you're expert on. You talked about human connection. Why? And how did you think about this opportunity to give a commencement address?
Oh, my goodness. Well, for one thing, it was the sweetest day, Jennifer. I'm looking out at these graduates. There were 300-something of them. And, you know, I grew up down the road from where I was speaking. And half of them were first-generation grads. 85% of them were from Maine. And then I'm looking up the hill at their families. You know, nobody's all dressed up. It's a very kind of Western Maine crowd. And I'm looking out there. I'm thinking, these are my people right here. This is my tribe. And so I felt unbelievably honored in my, you know, my outfit and the hat and the whole business. And I just really kind of felt like a little girl from Mexico, Maine on that stage, not far from where these kids are. You know, they're just starting out their lives. But I was there once, right where they were, and it was such an honor. And when I started thinking about what to do for a commencement address, I've always had a dread that somebody would ask me to do that, honestly, because I think it's really hard to do one that's not one you've heard a million times before. So I thought, well, what can I bring to this? And what I can bring to this is I'm good at telling stories. So I thought, I'm just going to pick a story, tell it, and mine whatever I can from it. And so I picked a story about one day Dan and I were walking on Forest Avenue and there was a man lying on the sidewalk. And so it ended up being a story about connecting with strangers and being kind And
being the person who stops to help.
Yeah, which wasn't me. It was my husband. My instinct was the same as everybody else who had already passed this person by, is to just keep going. But it is something about one person doing the right thing that all of a sudden everyone does the right thing. And all the people coming up behind us stopped to say, how can we help? It was quite a profound little incident. And the point of the story really was how connected the helpers felt, that, you know, something had happened to us as human beings. And I don't know what their political persuasions were, or, you know, whether we would have gotten along in real life. It's just for that moment, we were just connected humans. And it was, we need so many more of those kinds of interactions. And sometimes we have to look for them. And that's really what my talk was about.
I bet everybody there will remember yours. And most people talk about how they don't remember commencement speeches. So bravo and good job on that. Let's talk about your new novel, How to Read a Book, the one that's getting so much attention. Out tomorrow, right?
It's out tomorrow, yep.
Okay. This book might not have been published. December of 2022, something really big happened. It was in the hands of the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Tell that story.
Well, it was in the chute. The only thing that was left is it might not have been proofread yet, but everything else was done. It had been copy edited. The galleys were about to be printed. I had to approve the cover. And I got an email from somebody who wasn't my editor. And that's when I realized that HarperCollins had been on strike for 2 days. And I didn't even know about it. It wasn't very reported at first. And I thought, oh, my gracious, what am I going to do? There's no way I'm crossing a picket line even if I can't see it. I know it's there. And so I pulled the book from publication. And I didn't really, you know, I mean, at the time, there was really no other choice. There was no other choice. But I also wondered what was going to happen to this book it was so ready, and I had a great team, and I felt that it was going to be published well. A year later, here we are. The strike ended up lasting for 3 months, so it was way too late for, you know, there's so much pre-publication stuff that has to happen before a book comes out. So it was way too late for it to make the original spring list or even the summer list for that year. And so the publisher decided, instead of just kind of cramming it into the next possible slot, we would wait a year to give it the best shot it could get, which was really nice. I appreciated that a lot. I feel like they've had my back in that way. And so here we are, exactly a year later than it was supposed to come out. And it's funny how things happen. You know, maybe if I had just let the book be published anyway last year, I don't know if it may have been assigned to the New York Times, but maybe to somebody who didn't like it as much as the reviewer who gave it such a nice review. It might not be the People magazine book of the week. You know, it's just a funny thing. Timing is interesting.
Yeah, you're being humble, though, because that was pretty brave. It was pretty brave to say, I have written this novel. I've spent months, years of my life writing this. And I'm just going to say no. And you didn't know in that moment if it would ever be published.
No. But
you said you didn't have a choice.
I didn't.
You made a choice that most authors did not make. And I know at the time you were frustrated with other authors, but perhaps they don't have your background.
I think that is true. And I'm not judging anyone who made a different decision. They have different lives and different needs and different everything. But you're right. I mean, my background is a dyed-in-the-wool union family, and it was just in my DNA to understand what a breach that would have been to put my possible success over the rights of these people who were striking for such righteous reasons. They weren't asking for the moon. They'd been underpaid for years. And the thing that's so wonderful about how it all came out, it lasted 3 months to the day, and they got what they wanted. And the other two, I think two or three of the other big five publishers negotiated something with their people. They're not unionized, but they negotiated new contracts, I think, exactly because of what happened at HarperCollins. So I think it worked out very well, not for just the striking workers at HarperCollins, but people at, you know, the other big publishers.
Let's talk about the novel itself.
Okay.
How to Read a Book. It starts with, it starts in a prison.
Mm-hmm.
Violet, the protagonist, well, there are three protagonists, is in prison, and she's in a prison book club.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get that idea? Have you run a prison book club, Monica?
I have. And it was about, oh gosh, 9 or 10 years ago now, and I did it for about 3 years. And it was a wonderful experience. If you ever want to feel truly appreciated, volunteer in a prison. Because the big thing about prison, it is so boring. The boredom just gets to you. And if you have somebody coming in with something from the outside, and especially something that's intellectually stimulating, I found that the women, this is out in Windham, they were starved for intellectual stimulation. And we had wonderful discussions. And I mean, it's not, the characters in my book are not based on the women that I knew. But the experience, that feeling that Harriet, who's the character who runs the club, who's honestly not much like me except that she's doing that, that feeling that I had of being at home there and being feeling appreciated and also just thoroughly enjoying the kind of cheeky, irreverent sassiness of the way the women would respond to certain things. It was really such a pleasure.
Are any of the characters in the book based on the women that you knew?
No.
No?
Mm-mm. No. In fact, I intentionally did that. I didn't want to use that experience in any way, you know, exploit that experience in any way. And it's not like, I mean, that wasn't my research for the book. It just happened to be an experience I had in my life that crept into the book at hand. There are other things that I had to research in the book, but that is just something that was in my life that I picked up as something for one of my characters.
Well, one thing that you had to research was your character, Frank, who had had a career as a machinist. Mm-hmm. And you describe what it's like to be a machinist very well because, finish the sentence.
Well, my husband works at SMCC. He's in architectural and engineering design technology. His dad was a machinist. Dan himself was a machinist with his dad early on. So I knew a little something about that world. But the thing that's so much fun about writing is it's a little bit like acting, I would think, is that you just kind of try on other personas. And to do that effectively, at least for me, to feel like I have permission to create a character, I have to experience something of their life. So I felt like I need to figure out what does it feel like to hold a piece of metal in my hand with intention, to understand what its possibilities are. I had no idea. So Dan hooked me up with the machine tool department at SMCC, and I took a class with, it was me and 12 19-year-old boys and our teacher, and it was wonderful, and I learned lots of things. I learned, for one thing, how hard it is on the body to stand at a milling machine for 4 hours at a time. I did understand how it felt to hold a piece of metal in my hand with some intention, just the weight of it, the feeling of it. And I couldn't get that experience any other way. So it was really fun. I also, as part of this, I took a print reading class with my husband. I mean, he was the teacher. And we did this thing called orthographic projection, which is 10 times more boring than it sounds. And it's about transforming, he's probably listening to this, it's about transforming a 3D object onto a flat page, so into 2D. And I have zero spatial perception. I mean, I've been tested. I have none. And so this was quite a challenge for me. So what you're supposed to do is he gives you this object, and you're supposed to draw it in three views. So I could get two of them, and the third one, I just can't see this. And so I drew a cartoon Snoopy with a balloon saying, I'm not doing this. And so Dan's walking through the class, and he's looking at everybody's work, and he says, yep, that, oh, good, that looks good. good. And he comes by me, never misses a beat. That's wrong. And then just keeps going. And the students kind of looked up and they're thinking, he just told his wife it was wrong. It was very funny.
Speaking of research, and I do not want to give away the plot because I want everyone to read this, but there are parrots.
Oh, gosh.
Very bright parrots.
Very, yes.
And in a lab. Do you know some parrots, Monica?
I do. I met the parrots. These parrots are based on these parrots that I met. And there's this woman. She's a behavioral psychology scientist. I mean, she's a brainiac, really. She's been doing research for decades on avian cognition. And her subjects are African gray parrots. And what they are capable of cognitively is really, really astonishing. So this, I just made it in because it was right before the pandemic started, just before. And I think, if I'd waited one more month, I never would have met them. And her lab at the time, I don't know where she is now, but her lab at the time was at Harvard. So it was December of 2019. It was right before Christmas. And I remember it was snowing. I took the train down. I go across the campus and I go in this very modest, unprepossessing lab. And I open the door and there's this parrot named Athena. She was 8 years old, kind of a party girl. She didn't really want to work that hard. And she lifts her foot and, you know, this is radio, so you can't really see it, but they do this funny thing. If they want to get on you, they'll lift their foot and it looks like they're waving at you. It was the most, I melted into my shoes, like right there. I could talk about these parrots forever. But it's sort of the same thing. I didn't know what it felt like to have a parrot sitting on your shoulder. They're very warm. They have a very high resting temperature. And so they kind of lean against your face and you can feel the warmth. But also the other one's name is Griffin and he's 23 or 4, I think. So he's really hitting his stride as far as what he knows how to do. But Jennifer, these parrots can organize by number, color, and material. They can count up to like 7 or 8. They whooped the asses of a bunch of Harvard freshmen at a game, you know, the shell game where you're trying to keep track of an item that is under these cups. I mean, Griffin just took them to town. It's amazing. So, and I've been interested in parrots for a really long time and about intelligence in that species for a really long time. And I've just been waiting for a book into which I could insert that somehow. So I gave Violet a job in this lab.
We are speaking with author and playwright Monica Wood. I have so many more questions, but I just looked at the clock and I know I have to take a break. This is Maine Calling. What are your questions for Monica? The phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are discussing Monica Wood's new novel, How to Read a Book. We are also discussing a whole lot more than the novel. Monica Wood is our guest. You may know her from her memoir, When We Were the Kennedys, or from her recent play, Saint Dad. You can join our conversation with an email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Monica, it's hard to sum up what the book, the novel is about, but I was thinking a couple words. One, decency. Another, second chances. And then I started thinking, you know, a lot of literature isn't about things like decency and second chances. Yet you not only write about it beautifully and with sophistication, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, you almost seem like you're planting your flag in the ground and saying, watch me. Watch me do this thing that doesn't seem to be so popular in contemporary fiction. Am I wrong?
Wow, that is a great question. I don't know if I'm planting a flag. I mean, this is just who I am and what I do. But I think a lot of people, one of the things that thrilled me about the New York Times review is that I felt the reviewer was giving a lot of respect to how much craft it takes to write about decency. It's kind of easy to write about evil, and it's not easy at all to write about goodness, because it's goodness kind of, you know, you can rub up against sentimentality or things that are a little corny or treacly. And so, you know, to stay away from that line and still bring the full heart and soul of the characters who are doing the best they can in usually very difficult circumstances. That's what I traffic in. You know, I think in my real life and in my fiction, about how people, really it's about how people crave connection and how people form families out of the most, out of broken parts, basically. And I wouldn't want to write any other way, even if the other way is, might be more popular. Or, but I think at this point, I think people are craving literature about decency. And that, you know, we're just living in such grim times. And to have a novel that's more life-affirming, it's just, give me those. That's what I want to be reading right now.
You mentioned your husband, Dan. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that he posted on YouTube your yes. speech from Saturday. And you and Dan were here in our studio a few years ago talking about the horrible year that he had. If you all did not hear the program, if you don't remember, Dan had a psychotic break and shot himself with a... What kind
a
of
flare gun?
Flare gun, and has had multiple surgeries. And this is happening at the same time that you are Monica Wood, your beloved author. Dan is a beloved professor at Southern Maine Community College. You live these public lives. How are you both today?
We're doing great. Dan could not be better. And I do feel like we have, you know, we've put some light out there. You know, we've done a few public things together to medical communities. And, you know, as and in Dan's own life, he's just so forthright about what happened and how these things do happen to people. It's so funny. I just had a conversation this morning. I was out birding at Kapisik Pond, and I ran into somebody I don't see very often, but I like him, and he's a fellow birder. And this is migration, you know, so we're all out there. And he was asking me about it and then talking about how his dad has a very dear friend who's going through a psychotic event right now. And somehow I think that the idea that people can get through these things gives so much hope to people who are experiencing it. And it also, I think, limits the shame that they have over having to go through something like this, because there's so much shame involved with it. And if you can just put it out there as just, this is part of the human experience, and it's way more common than you think it is, it just allows people to live with, you know, the feelings they're having around what's happening to them.
Do you said somebody said something to you just this morning.
Yeah.
And this was 8 years ago. Does this happen regularly?
Yeah, it happens fairly regularly, and you know, for one reason or another. But it, you know, it's really funny, because when he asked me, he said, "You know, how is your husband?" And Dan's had he's been down with a back issue for the last week. I said, "Oh, he's fine. You know, he's just, you know, he's still limping around a little bit." And And then he looked at me kind of funny, and I thought, "Oh, I understand what you mean." And that wasn't the first thing that came to, I don't really even think of it most of the time. It seems like ancient history right now, because he's so well. But, you know, yeah, it does come up. Like now, it just came up.
Well, another reason you've been on Maine Calling before is with your Starfish writing group. The five of you who review each other's books, read copies, support each other. First of all, what's the review that Starfish gives the recent book, How to Read a Book?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we all have books out this year, which is kind of amazing. So I was the third. So Kate Christensen's book, Welcome Home, Stranger, came out, I think, maybe just before the year started. And so we're all, yay, you know, because we've all read these books 1,000 times for each other. So we feel... It's very kind of proprietary. I mean, I feel like I had a hand in all of, we all feel like we've had a hand in all of these books. And then Sarah Bronstein, her novel Bad Animals just came out like maybe a month ago, and now mine is out. And then Bill Rohrbach, his novel Beep is coming out in July. And then the last for this year is Lewis Robinson, who has a book called The Islanders, and that's coming out in, I think, mid-September. So it's just kind of funny. It, you know, we certainly didn't plan it this way, but here we are. All, you know, we've been together for 8 years, reading this and that, and, I mean, literally hundreds of pages for each other multiple times. And 2024, we all have books arriving. So that's kind of cool.
And just to be clear, this is not usual.
I don't think so.
This is not usual to have really fine authors who regularly meet as a team, as a unit, and work with each other and help each other. In college, you get that. You take a writing workshop,
yeah,
or maybe
yeah.
you enroll at something at the mm-hmm. library. But to have some people, writers of your caliber who are so close, mm-hmm. Kind of unusual.
I don't know if it is. I, you know, this is my first writing group ever, and now I don't think I could write another word without them. You know, I never had one before. And, you know, this is pretty late in my career to be starting with a writing group. But I find them invaluable to my process now.
I have an email here from Donna. I met Monica a while ago, and she met my African gray,
oh,
Zimmy.
Yes.
She's doing a signing at our library in Gray, and I wonder if she'd like me to bring him in to say hi.
I would. Hello, Donna. I would love it. Zimmy, I have to say, so modestly, Zimmy liked me. And he doesn't like everybody, but he liked me. I'm crazy about parrots.
Does Zimmy and do other parrots know that you're a cat person?
We'll keep that between us. You know, it's funny. A friend visited me one time with a parrot, and my cat at the time was just a big gush ball and just not a mouser, just a, you know, just a wonderful old gushy cat. And I thought, she's not even going to register that this is a bird, you know? And so we put the parrot was in a cage. We put it on the coffee table, and the cat immediately assumed the position, like the crouch position of, and I thought, holy cow, it's a good thing
instinct.
We didn't just bring it in on somebody's arm.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And the other thing I have to ask you, Monica, it has come out before when we've discussed that you're a Patriots fan.
Oh.
Are you still a Patriots fan?
Of course I am. You don't, you
even
know.
Even with Tommy gone?
Yes, even with Tom gone. And even with the horrible couple of years we've had, I have a little bit of hope now with Drake May. I'm hoping, you know, they won't ruin him the way they ruined Mac. But yeah, we'll see. I'm cautiously optimistic that we shall rise again. But we had a pretty damn good run. So, you know, now we know how all the other football fans have felt for decades.
So I already knew you're a cat person and a football fan, but now I've found out that you're a birder. Is there anything to see this year? We haven't done a birding show in a few weeks. What have you seen at Kapisik Pond?
The early warblers are all in black and white. I saw a yellow warbler today for the first time. I saw my first oriole today. The only thing that was kind of, I wasn't expecting was a Nashville warbler today. That was at Kapisik Pond. I also bird over at Evergreen Cemetery. And it's been kind of a funny year this year because I had this birder friend named Arthur Stackhouse, and he died last year at 93. And we used to go out all the time birding. And just before he died, we decided that my Arthur bird would be, we didn't want something so common that I would see it all the time or something so rare that I would never see it. So we picked the Eastern Kingbird because that was one of the last birds we saw together. And I haven't seen one yet, but I'm waiting to see my Eastern Kingbird, which will be my Arthur bird this year.
I don't know what an Arthur bird is.
Well, his name was Arthur.
I see.
And so when I see the Eastern Kingbird, that will be Arthur saying hello from the great beyond.
I love that. Did you know that birding is the most popular hobby in the United States?
What?
Yeah, more people bird. I think when they count that, they count everybody who buys a bird feeder as a birder.
Oh.
But still.
Well, that's how it starts. That's how the obsession starts. It's one bird feeder, and the next thing you know, you've gone right down the rabbit hole.
Monica, this is a novel, but many people know you because of your play. papermaker. Oh. You know, many people have seen that at Portland Stage Company or many of the other theaters that it's been produced at. And I'm wondering what's next for you. Are you now a novelist again? Are you going to go back and forth between plays and novels? Do you not have a plan?
Right now, I'm not writing anything, but I do have sort of buzzing in my head, way in the back of my head, and I don't know if it's a novel or a play. I'm thinking it's probably a play, and all I have so far, you know, a lot of writers don't, they think it's jinxy to talk about what they're, and I never do. I'm always
blabbing. Oh, well, then I'm sorry
blabbing.
To ask. If...
No, no, I'm a blabber. I just, I don't care who knows what I'm working on.
It's all worked out so far.
So far, so good. But all I'm thinking of is all I have, and this is very typical for, I don't usually have much when I start. All I have right now is two sisters of a certain age. So there's these two women, and one is coming to visit the other one, and there's some kind of conflict, but I don't know what it is. And then there's another generation of two women who are around 40, who are maybe a daughter and a cousin. And then there's a man who is just gumming up the works in some way, but I don't know. So that's all I have.
Is that how your ideas start?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's just so vague. It's so, but I have one of the characters already. I keep getting snippets of dialogue in my head for her, and the only thing I know about her so far is she is absolutely incapable of taking a compliment. And instead, she kind of turns it on the other person, like, how dare you even think that my hair looks good? It looks like this. It looks like, you know, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but that's where I am. It's all a big jumble.
It's so funny because we have an email here from Paul. I'm curious about the different mindset when it comes to writing a play versus a novel. How is her process different for each format?
Well, you know, what I love the most about writing novels is writing the dialogue in the novels. And for this one, I mean, writing dialogue for birds was really so fun. This was a fun book to write for a lot of reasons, but that was one of them. But you have a lot of other tools in a novel. You have, you know, you can, it's the interior stuff and scene setting and all these things that are also fun to do. But with a play, all you have is dialogue. You have to convey every single thing through dialogue. And I think my dialogue in general in my prose has gotten better because of the discipline required writing dialogue for plays, because each line of dialogue has to carry a lot, but it can't feel expository, but it has to reveal something about the character. Every single line has to reveal something about the character and even a little bit inch the story along somehow. And that's its job in a novel as well, but not as, it's not as military, you know, you can get away with more in dialogue in a novel.
As you were saying that, I thought, boy, does that sound hard.
It is hard, but it's also an acquired skill. I'm much better at it than I was as a young writer, and I love doing it. And once you know what you're doing, it really isn't that hard.
Do you listen? Do you keep a notebook when you're standing in line at the grocery store, or at the bowling alley, or in the bookstore? Are you hearing snippets of conversation saying, oh, I'm taking that?
I'm an outrageous eavesdropper. It's awful. And, you know, there are times when I'm like out to dinner with Dan and he's like, are you even listening to anything I'm saying? I'm like, no, be quiet. I want to find out what happened to so-and-so at the next table. I do that all the time, but I don't write it down. It's just, I'm always picking up things. I also have I love listening to how people put sentences together, like little, also regional dialects and things like that. I'm just very interested in how people speak.
That sounds fun.
It is fun. It's just part of the craft.
I read once that John Irving maps out his novels completely. He knows how they're going to end. He knows what the final words are going to be before he starts writing. And when I told your friend Rick Russo that, he thought that sounded terrible. And
yeah,
he said he never knows how novels are going to end when he starts them. Where are you in this spectrum?
I'm with Rick. I'm absolutely with Rick. If I knew every single thing, I mean, why even bother writing it if you already... I mean, I like to be surprised. You know, especially a first draft. I mean, by the time you get the first draft, then you know. But then there's other fun stuff, like how you... sentence to sentence, how you're crafting that. But for the first draft, which can be... awful. I mean, it takes forever. It takes me forever. But the fun of it is not knowing what's going to happen. If I knew what was going to happen, I probably would, you know, start another novel instead. Sometimes I have a vague thought, like how it's going to end, usually an image or maybe a line, not usually, but I like flying blind that way. I think if you're surprised, then your reader is going to be surprised.
How many drafts are usual? How many drafts for how to read a book?
Oh, countless, but it's hard to say because, well, this one is a little bit different. Usually I revise a lot as I'm going. This one I didn't so much because I thought, you know, maybe for once in your life you can write a novel fast because it takes me so long. And this was a little faster than usual. Also, a lot of it was written during COVID when I had literally nothing else to do. So this was a 2-year novel and most of them take 4. So it was exactly half the time. But I think probably I put double time in because of the shutdown and everything. So it's a little hard to tell. But this one I thought, I'm going to just go right to the end and see if I can get a story out there, a bad one, ill-written, you know, and then go back and make it. Why are you shaking your head?
A bad one. Well, I'm talking to Monica Wood, by the way.
No. I mean, first drafts are usually pretty bad. You know, they don't have any of the, you know, polish that you want at the end.
I'm sure that many aspiring writers right now, I'm breathing a sigh of release with all of you to hear that for most novels, it takes Monica Wood 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
For everybody who has sat at their computer and tried to write something and become frustrated with themselves after a week or two or a couple months is nothing, it sounds like.
A couple of months is less than nothing. Oh my goodness. I mean, I'm lucky if I get one decent page in a day because it's hard to describe. Sometimes I just sit with it. You know, I'm listening or I'm thinking, just sort of dreaming about the characters and it looks like it's not any work at all, but it really is. I mean, it's not as hard as coal mining, but it's not easy. It's a wonderful way to work. I mean, I feel very lucky that this is what I do. But there's just a lot of craft involved and a lot of, you know, things like structure, things like what comes first, what point of view it's going to be. And sometimes things start out sort of feeling preordained, like, you know, this is going to be a present tense. This is the main character. You know, I'm going to do it this way. I'm going to do it chronologically, etc. And you start writing it, and all of that just goes out the window. And I'm actually astonished that John Irving works that way. And to tell you the truth, I really don't believe it because I love his novels. They're wonderful. And I don't quite believe that he, like A Prayer for Owen Meany is one of my favorite novels. And I do not believe that he mapped that out because there are so many detours and I'm sure he had an idea of that wonderful ending in the airport. I don't know if you remember the book, but it's an astonishing ending. And he's really good at plotting. And maybe he's really good at plotting because he outlines it. I don't know. But I'm skeptical of that.
We are speaking with author and playwright Monica Wood. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email if you're quick to talk@mainepublic.org or post a comment on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. My guest today, author and playwright Monica Wood. We are discussing her work, including her new novel, How to Read a Book. Share your questions and comments. If you're really quick, you can send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. Find us on Facebook or Instagram, or best, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I have an email here from Bill, who is listening from the Villages in Florida. He writes, "Has there been any interest from Hollywood for any of the novels or plays?"
You know, it's very hard to get a movie done these days that isn't a franchise movie, you know, a superhero movie, one of those. It's really hard to get, you know, something that's from a literary novel. This, I have nothing here yet. I mean, I have had options on books before, but nothing ever. And I don't expect it. Nothing ever happens. I mean, I have a lot of friends who've had books optioned, and almost never does something come of it. So from your lips to God's ears, Bill, and we shall see.
Well, I asked Monica the same question when she walked in this morning. I think that this most recent book, How to Read a Book, would make a beautiful movie. Here's an email from Sam. I recall you are in a writer's group, and you all critique each other's work. As a hopeful one-day-to-be-published writer, I'd love your advice on taking constructive criticism. I know for me, when I write something, I usually don't want to change a word, so receiving feedback tends to be tough. Do I just need a thicker skin? How can I look at this differently? Thanks, and I loved When We Were the Kennedys.
Oh, that's very sweet. Wow. You know, I don't think it's about thicker skin. I think it's about an openness to let something else into the work that you may not know is waiting there for you. Yes, it's hard to take criticism, but I think when you get better at it, that's when you know you're maturing as a writer, when you realize that you don't know every single thing about the story that you're telling. And as at my writer's group, we're very frank with each other when something is not working, but we're all established writers who know what it's like to work with editors. We've all worked with many different editors on different things. And I'm proud to say I've never had a bad relationship with an editor. I've respected all my editors. They've respected me. I have an editor right now who's very young. She's maybe, I don't know, 26 years old. And she has turned out to be a wonderful editor. And what she does very well, which is, I think, the sign of a good editor, is she tries to bend the work not to her will, but to the book's will. So she can ask the right questions so that I and she can figure out what the book wants to be. Like, you know, sometimes you try to force, you know, a plot point or some characteristic of the protagonist, and it's not really working, but you want it to be that way, maybe because, oh, I always wanted to write about such and such. And yet that story is not the story for that. And so it takes maturity and really just an openness to, you know, when I hear things like, I don't want to change anything, I have an image of somebody just clutching the manuscript and the pages are crinkling and it's close to their chest. And that's not the way. You have to open, let it float out there, just open your hands. Sometimes if you do that physically open your body to help, you can get that feeling like, oh, okay, I can let something else in. I'm not the last word on all of this.
Have you ever done something really dramatic with your editor? Have you ever dropped a whole chapter or removed a character?
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because Ernie's Ark, which first came out in 2002, I had a great editor. I loved him, Jay Schaefer. And it was originally 10 stories. And he thought I should take one of the stories out. And I really liked that story and said, I think it belongs in there. And eventually he convinced me that he was right and I was wrong. And I still kind of wanted it in there, but I thought he has a better perspective right now on this than I do. So I agreed to take it out. So it was 9 stories. Well, fast forward 20 years, and it was republished in an anniversary edition by Godin Publishing. And the editor there is Josh Bodwell. And I just happened to mention, you know, there used to be 10 stories. He says, what? And asked me to send that 10th story. And he thought it did belong. And so in the most recent version of Ernie's Ark, it is the original. It is 10 stories. So it's funny. But I do think that 20 years ago, it didn't belong in there. And somehow now it does.
Well, it gives the new edition something fun and different.
Well, it does. That's true. So you know there's something new in it.
When you look at your writing from that long ago, do you recognize it? Do you remember writing it? Do you remember, or does it feel like you're reading somebody else?
Well, I don't usually reread my work. And I recently reread Any Bitter Thing because that was also coming out in a new edition from Godin. It came out last year. And it had been long enough that I forgot plot points. I forgot a whole character. It was amazing. And it was really fun to have the experience of reading a novel that just seemed to have been written by somebody else. And I really enjoyed it. It was good.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
You spend 4 years of your life on something and then it's gone.
Yeah, it's kind of gone.
Wow, fascinating. An email here from Cynthia. The Meeting House Theater Lab is putting a production of Monica's Saint Dad on May 17th, 18th, 19th, 24th, 25th, and 26th. More information at scudicarts.org. How exciting.
It's very exciting. I'm so pleased about that.
An email from Nicole. I just wanted to say Monica Wood's commencement address was exactly what the UMF community needed. Thank you. And this is from a professor at UMF who is also a commencement marshal.
Oh, how nice. Thank you so much for saying that.
From Katie, what kind of books did you like to read when you were growing up? Any particular genres? And do you think someone has to be a voracious reader to be a good writer?
Yes. That's a hard
For
yes.
the record, I have run into Monica in downtown Portland carrying two satchels full of books coming from a bookstore. So I know you're voracious. Either that or you're just carrying around 50 pounds of books for the fun of it.
No, it was not an exercise. I'm a big book buyer and borrower and everything else. I read all the time. I do think you have to be a voracious reader because that's how you learn to write. I mean, you can take classes and all of that, but I think most writers learn to write by reading. What I read as a kid, you know, nothing fancy. I read Little Women a million times. I read Anne of Green Gables a million times. I, you know, I'm of the Nancy Drew generation. I read all the Nancy Drews. We lived on the third floor of an apartment building, and on the second floor, this woman lived there, and she had the whole collection of Nancy Drews that she had read when she was young. And it was like my own little lending library. I would go downstairs, knock on the door, and say, I just finished The Secret of the Old Clock. And then she'd go, okay, well, this is number two. This is the second one in the volume. And I'd read that one. I went through her whole bookshelf several times in my childhood.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. Outside of your own and outside of your Starfish author's books, what are your current favorites? What are you recommending to people to read?
I just read a story collection by Elizabeth McCracken, and I can't remember what it's called right now. I love her work so much. She's a very humane writer. I also read, and this is also stories, an author I discovered last year, and I'm thinking, where have you been all my life? Her name is Danielle Evans, and she has two short story collections. One is called Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self, which is a great title, and the other is called The Department of Historical Corrections. She's a fantastic writer. Every story feels like a little novel in itself, a wonderful writer. And one of the novels I read this past year that I loved a lot was Trust by Hernan Diaz. Have you read that?
I have not.
It is fabulous. And it's one of those books that it has five parts, could be four. I think it's five parts. And it takes a really long time before you understand what you're reading. Mm. Each part seems so different from the preceding, and yet it all fits together as you approach the end. It was a fantastic book.
Well, How to Read a Book hits bookstores tomorrow.
Yes, it does.
And there's a big event tomorrow night, but it's sold out.
Mm.
But tell me about your next couple weeks. What is, in the post-COVID world, what does an author tour look like for you, Monica Wood?
Well, you know, I love Maine libraries, and I said I am going to try to hit as many Maine libraries as I can between now and I decided October 4th is the end of this madness. So I'm everywhere from York to Fort Kent. I'm going to be around the state, which is something I really want to do. This week, tomorrow is the book launch at Portland Stage. And then Wednesday night, I'm in Rumford, the home crowd. at the American Legion at 7. And then the night after that, I'm at Left Bank Books in Belfast. It's a lovely bookstore, and they're hosting me at 6:30. And next week, I think I have just one thing next week, and it's in Kennebunk, and I can't remember the details. But I'm going to put all this on my website. So if you want to find, just go to the calendar on my website, which is a little bit of a mess, but you can find out where I'm going to be.
But it's going to be a whirlwind, a five-month whirlwind.
Yes, it will. Yeah.
Tour of Maine. Let's see. I have a note from my producer, Cindy Hahn. Is Elizabeth Kracken's story collection called Souvenir Museum?
Yes, it is. The Souvenir Museum. Elizabeth McCracken.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Monica, it's always such a pleasure to have you on the program. And, you know, why don't I just wrap by asking you sort of that dreaded question that we love to ask, which is, what do you hope people come away with when they read your novel?
I hope, you know, the way I do with anything that I write, I hope they feel as if they've traveled for a little while along a path they wouldn't have normally traveled with people they would not normally have traveled with, and feel better about being a human being rather than worse.
And in this case, some of those people are people who have committed serious crimes.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Monica Wood, always so fun to have you on Maine Calling. Author and playwright, her new novel, How to Read a Book, getting all kinds of attention, New York Times, People Magazine, not just attention from those of us here in Maine. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's wonderful.
It's been a pleasure.
Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or to listen to past programs, more than 10 years worth of past programs. And if you sign up for our newsletter, you will be entered into a drawing for a Maine Calling mystery book bundle. There's also a new way to get in touch with us. You can download the Maine Public Vox Pop app. It's a quick and easy way to get a message to us or to reply to the occasional question we will ask. That's the Maine Public Vox Pop app. Tomorrow on the program, a look at the busy and dynamic performing arts season already underway throughout the state. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.